This is disc number 20.
The Book of Life carried meaning that had forced Nikki to look at the world of life in a new way. In a way that very much reminded her of the way Richard had always looked at the world, through a prism of excitement, wonder, and love of life. In a way, it was a profound recognition of the precise nature of things, an appreciation of things for what they were, not for what people imagined of them. In part, that was because the Book of Life was not just additive, but subtractive magic, in the same way that death was part of the process of life. It dealt with the whole. For that reason, Nikki couldn't explain it to Zed. He didn't possess the ability to use subtractive magic. Without that ability, a constituent part of what was needed to understand the Book of Life was missing. She could explain the formulas, lay out the procedures, show him the spells, but much of it he could only observe through the filter of his limited ability. While he could intellectually understand some of it, he couldn't actually perform what was involved. It was something like the difference between hearing about love, understanding the depth of such feelings, grasping how it affected people, but never having actually experienced it. Without that experience, it was only academic, sterile. Until you felt the magic, you didn't know it. It was in that sense that Nikki had come to know that Richard had memorized a false key. She had been right before, in that if the person who put the boxes in play failed to use the key properly, the boxes would be destroyed along with the one who put them in play. But it was more than that simple statement. There was the whole complex nature of the processes involved in using the boxes that demonstrated that concept in ways that the words only presented in a simplified, condensed manner. Through the mechanisms in the book, she could glimpse how the power functioned. By understanding that function on a profound level, she could see how the magic, if invoked, needed and used the key for completion. Through grasping that process, she could see how if the key was used improperly, the boxes themselves were inescapably destroyed along with the person making the fatal mistake. The magic simply would not allow such a breach to go uncompleted. It would be like tossing a rock and without any outside influence or intervention, having it float in midair, rather than fall back to the ground. It simply would not happen. In the same way, the magic of Orden had laws of its identity. By the way it functioned, by those laws of its identity, it had to destroy the boxes if the key were not properly used. The rock had to fall. When Richard used his memory of what he believed was the Book of Counted Shadows, he changed it in order to trick Darkenrall into opening the wrong box. But it had only been the wrong box named in a clever simulation that seemed as if it had meaning to the Book of Life. In fact, such a book was only a shrewd fake, a false key. Had it been real, and misused in such a way, the boxes would no longer exist. A false key, a clever fake, simply could not trigger the power of Orden to destroy the boxes, but the real key, if used in the fashion that Richard had used it, would have caused the entire structure of the spell to collapse in on itself, taking the boxes with it. The boxes of Orden, after all, had been created for the purpose of countering the Chainfire spell. To misuse the key meant that someone without the proper intention and knowledge was trying to gain access to Orden's power, in essence, tampering with the purpose for which it had been created. The Book of Life made it all too clear within the structure of the spell forms that, as a safeguard, if everything was not done correctly, namely, completed with the key in the exact prescribed manner, the formulas and spells would self-destruct, not altogether unlike the way in which Richard had shut down the verification web, collapsing it to save Nikki. Richard had memorized a false key. That was the truth of it. "What is it?" came Zed's voice. Nikki looked back over her shoulder to see the old wizard marching across the vast rampart. She knew that she had to set aside the things she had been considering. Telling Zed about the false key now would only cause him to want to argue. Arguing with Zed would serve no purpose. Richard was the one who really needed to know that the key he possessed was false. "Four riders," Nikki told him. Zed came to a halt at the wall. He peered down at the road and grunted to indicate that he saw them. "Looks like Tom and Friedrich to me," Kara said. They must have found someone sneaking around. I don't think so, Nicky said. They hardly look like prisoners. I can see the glint of steel. The man is carrying weapons. Tom would have disarmed anyone he thought was a threat. Besides, the other one looks like a little girl.
Rachel?
Zed asked, frowning as he leaned out farther, trying to see better between the trees far down the road. It would not be many more days until those golden brown leaves were gone for the season.
Do you really think it could be her?
That's my guess, Nicky said. He turned and appraised her critically. You look terrible. Thank you, she said. Just what a woman likes to hear from a gentleman. He huffed a dismissal of his rude manners. When's the last time you got any sleep? Nicky yawned again.
I don't know.
Last summer when I came back from the People's Palace with that book. He made a face at her rather poor attempt at humor. She didn't know why she tried to be funny with him. Zed could make people laugh just by grunting. Whenever she said anything she thought was rather amusing, people just stared at her. The way Kara was doing. How is it coming? He asked. Nicky knew what he meant. She pulled some hair back off her face, holding it back from the grasp of the wind. I could use your help with some star charts and angle calculations. It might speed things up if I didn't have to do those myself. I could go on to some of the other translations and problems. Zed laid a hand tenderly on her back, giving her a gentle rub that conveyed a personal, comforting warmth. On one condition.
What's that?
She asked as she yawned again. You get some sleep. Nicky smiled as she nodded. All right, Zed. She gestured, pointing with her chin. First, I think we had better get down there to see who our guests are. They were just coming out the big door of the keep at the side entrance with the paddock when the riders came under the arched opening in the wall. Tom and Friedrich were escorting Chase and Rachel. Rachel's hair was chopped short, rather than long the way it had been. And Chase looked to be in surprisingly good health for a man who had been stabbed with the sword of truth.
Chase! Zed shouted. You're alive!
Well, it's hard to ride a horse upright when you're dead. Kara chuckled. Nicky glanced at her, wondering where the woman's sudden appreciation for humor had come from.
Found them returning, Tom said. First people we've seen out there in months.
It was good to see Rachel back, Friedrich said. The older man regarded the girl with a grin, showing how much he really meant it.
Zed caught Rachel as she slipped from the saddle while Kara took the reins of the horse.
My, but you're getting heavy, Zed told her.
Chase rescued me, Rachel said. He was so brave. You should have seen him. He killed 100 men all by himself.
100? My, my, what an accomplishment.
You stabbed one in the leg for me, Chase said as he swung down out of his saddle. Otherwise, I'd only have gotten 99.
Rachel kicked her legs, eager to be put down.
Zed, I brought something important with me.
Once on the ground, she untied a leather bag hanging right behind her saddle. She brought it to the granite steps and set it down, then undid the drawstring. When she pushed back the leather covering, darkness came out into the crisp late autumn daylight. To Nicky, it felt like looking into the inky obscurity of Jagang's eyes.
Rachel, Zed said in astonishment. Where did you get this?
A man, Samuel, who had Richard's sword, had it. He stabbed Chase and took me with him. Then he gave it to a witch woman named Six and to Violet, the Queen of Tamarang, though I don't think she's queen anymore. You can't believe how evil Six is.
I think I can imagine, Zed told her. Having a little trouble following the story, he lifted the leather bag a little for a better look inside. Staring at one of the boxes of wardens sitting on the steps before her, Nicky felt as if her heart was in her throat. After the weeks and weeks of study of the book that went with the boxes, to actually see one was startling. Theory was one thing, but to see the reality of what this object represented was altogether something else.
I couldn't let them have it, Rachel told Zed. So when I got a chance to escape, I stole it and took it with me.
Zed ruffled her chopped-off blonde hair. You did good, little one. I always knew you were special. Rachel hugged the wizard around the neck.
Six made Violet draw pictures of Richard. It scared me to see what they were doing.
In a cave? Zed asked. When Rachel nodded, he glanced up at Nicky.
That explains a lot.
Nicky took a step closer. Was Richard there? Did you see him?
Rachel shook her head.
No, Six left one day. When she finally came back, she told Violet that she had been bringing him back, but the Imperial Order captured him.
The Imperial Order? Zed said.
Nicky tried to imagine what was worse, the witch-woman having Richard in her clutches, or the Imperial Order capturing him. She guessed that what was the worst was Richard stripped of his gift, his sword, and being in the hands of the Order.
Chapter 56 Kaelin pulled her cloak tighter around herself as she walked beside the Emperor, his constant, compliant companion. It was not by choice, of course, but by force, whether applied or implied. At night she slept on the carpet beside his bed, a constant reminder of where she would end up. During the day she remained always at his side, like his dog on a leash. Her leash, though, was an iron collar, with which he could bring her to heel at any time. She could not imagine what could engender such hatred for her. What could have given rise to his burning need to bring punishment down on her for the sins he saw in all his enemies? Whatever she had done to earn his hatred, he deserved it. When a gust of bitter cold wind ripped through the encampment, Kaelin hid the side of her face behind her cloak. Men turned their faces away from the blast of grit carried in the wind. With autumn rapidly drawing to an end, winter would soon be upon them. Kaelin didn't think it was going to be at all pleasant out on the open plain around the plateau that held the People's Palace. But she also knew that with this bone in his teeth, Jagang wasn't going to let it go for anything. He was nothing if not tenacious. There was supposed to be another copy of the Book of Counted Shadows hidden somewhere within that plateau, and Jagang meant to have it. Out on the Azrith Plain, the construction ground onward. It had been going on throughout the autumn, and she knew it would go on into winter, all winter, if necessary, until it was complete. If that was, the ground beneath them didn't freeze solid. Kaelin suspected that he had plans if that were to happen. Probably fires, if needed, to keep the dirt thawed. She supposed, too, that if it remained dry, the ground could still be dug even if it was freezing. There was no way to breach the great inner door into the plateau, and the road up the outside had quickly proven worthless for an attack by such vast numbers of men. Jagang had a solution to the predicament. He intended to construct a great ramped road, which would allow his army to march right up to the walls of the palace atop the plateau. He had told his officers that once they reached the walls, siege machines could be used to batter their way through the walls. First, though, they had to get up there. To that end, out beyond the vast encampment, closer to the plateau, the army was constructing the ramp. The width of the ramp was staggering. They needed it wide for two reasons, both equally important. They needed a ramp wide enough to eventually support an assault massive enough that it couldn't be turned back by the defenders. Just as important, the plateau towered above the Azrith Plain. For the ramp to reach that height, the base had to be monumental, lest the whole thing collapse. They had to, in essence, build a small mountain up against the plateau in order to reach the top. Tenacious indeed. The distance they had to their goal, from where they had started, was daunting. Because of the height, it required great length, so that men and equipment could eventually be marched and rolled up the roadway they were building up to the very walls of the People's Palace. It seemed at first to be a crazy idea, an impossible project. But what could be accomplished with millions of men who had nothing else to do and a driven emperor who cared nothing about their well-being was nothing short of astonishing. Every moment there was light, and sometimes by torchlight. Long, snaking files of men either carried containers of dirt and rock to the site of the ever-growing ramp, or dug up great mounds of supplies. Rock was mixed with the finer soil to make it stable. Other men had simple weighted tampers to pack the new dirt as it was dumped. Nearly all the men in the camp were engaged in the enterprise.
though the task was daunting. The progress made by so many men was continual. Inexorably, the ramp continued to grow. Of course, the higher it got, the longer it was going to take, because it would require so much more material. Kalin thought it appropriate that such men would assault fine construction of marble with dirt. It befit the philosophy of the Order to grub in the dirt in order to bring down some of man's finest work. Kalin couldn't imagine how long it was going to take to complete such a project. But Jagang had no intention of abandoning his plan until he was successful. The end was in sight, he often reminded his officers, and he expected complete devotion and sacrifice from all for their noble purpose. He was implacable in his determination to bring down the last bastion of freedom. From the edge of the Emperor's compound, as they observed the construction, Kalin saw a messenger coming in on horseback. To the south, she could see the long plume of dust rising from an approaching supply train. She had been checking on it for hours, watching it draw ever closer, and now the lead wagons were just beginning to enter camp. Jagang had been relieved to see the supply train finally arrive. An army as vast as this one required constant supplies of all sorts, but mainly food. Out on the Azeroth Plain, there was nowhere for the army to scavenge food. There were no farms, no crops, no herds of livestock. It would take constant resupply from the old world to keep the army alive, and building the Emperor's ramp up into the sky. After dismounting, the messenger approached and waited patiently. Jagang finally signaled several officers forward along with a man who'd ridden in. The man bowed. "Excellency, I come with the supplies the good people from our homeland have sent. Many sacrificed to see to it that our valiant troops have what they need to vanquish the enemy." "We can use the supplies, no doubt of that. The men are all working hard, and I need to keep up their strength. Our train also brings some of the Jala Dajin teams that wish to join the tournaments in the hopes of having the chance to one day play His Excellency's renowned team." "What teams are they?" Jagang asked, absently, as he scanned a manifest the messenger handed him. "Most are teams of our soldiers from various divisions. One is the team belonging to the commander of our supply train. To supplement his own men, he has gathered men from the New World along our journey north. He thinks that, with such men from the New World on his team, he can provide quite a spectacle for His Excellency's enjoyment." Jagang nodded as he continued to read the list. "It will do these heathens good to learn our ways. Jala Dajin is a good way to bring other peoples into our culture and customs. It diverts simple minds from the barren existence we all endure in this meaningless life." The man bowed. "Yes, Excellency." Jagang finally finished and looked up. "I've been hearing rumors. Is this team with the captives as good as I've heard?"
"They seem to be formidable, Excellency. They have defeated teams that no one thought they could beat. At first it was thought to have been simple luck. No one still thinks it is luck. They have a point man who is said to be the best ever seen."
Jagang grunted his skepticism. "I have the best on my team." The man bowed in apology.
"Yes, Excellency, of course you are correct."
"What word do you bring from our homeland?"
The man hesitated. "Excellency, I'm afraid that I must report some unsettling news. As the next supply train that was to follow after ours was assembling down in the old world, it was set upon and destroyed. All the recruits who were to be sent north with the train to reinforce our army... well, I'm afraid, Excellency, that they were all killed. Their heads were left on stakes beside the road. The line of stakes stretched from one town to the next. Both towns burned to the ground. A number of cities, along with forests and croplands, are burning. The fires are intense, and when the wind is right, we can smell the smoke even this far north. It is difficult to pin down exactly what is going on, except that the attackers are all reliably reported to be New World soldiers." Jagang glanced at Kalin. She suspected he was looking to see if she would smile, like the last time. She didn't need to smile. She could maintain a stony face and rejoice inwardly. She felt like cheering those unknown men far away who were beginning to vex Jagang with the damage they were causing. Almost as bad as the damage, rumors were sweeping through the camp. The attacks in their homeland were unsettling the men, who had always considered the old world not just invulnerable to such attack, but invincible as well. As the rumors spread,
they grew in weight among the men. Jagang had already executed a number of men for spreading such rumors. Since she had little interaction with the men, most didn't even see her, she didn't know if the executions quelled the rumors, but somehow she doubted it. If the rumors of such things unsettled the soldiers, Kaelin could only imagine the fear beginning to grip those in the old world. While their army was away seeking conquest, she imagined that the people back there were largely defenseless. The reports are, Excellency, that these marauders are destroying everything in their path. They burn crops, kill livestock, destroy mills, break dams, ruin every sort of craft producing goods for our noble effort to spread the word of the order. Particularly hard hit are those who give support to our people by teaching them the ways of the order. Those who instill the need to sacrifice for our effort to crush the heathens to the north. Jagang was remaining calm on the outside, but Kaelin, as well as the officers watching him, knew that inside he was boiling with rage.
Any idea who is going after our teachers, our leaders? Any particular unit of the enemy?
The man bowed another apology. Excellency, I regret to report that all of our teachers and the brothers who have been murdered trying to teach the ways of the Creator and the Order, well, every one of their corpses was found to be missing a right ear. Jagang's face went red with rage. Kaelin could see the muscles in his jaw and temples flex as he gritted his teeth.
Do you think it could be those same men who plagued us on our way up into the Midlands, Excellency? One of the officers asked.
Of course it is! Jagang roared. I want something done about this, he said, directing his orders to the officers. Do you understand?
Yes, Excellency, they all said as one as they bowed their heads and kept them bowed down. I want a stop put to this nuisance. We need those supply trains to continue coming. We're close to ending this war in a great victory. I will not allow our effort to fail. Do you understand?
Yes, Excellency, they all said together again, bowing deeper.
Then get to it, all of you!
As the men all departed to see to their orders, Jagang started marching away out of his compound. Kaelin felt the shock of pain from the collar prompting her to keep up with him. Armed men, as always, fell in around Jagang as his royal escort and guard. Chapter 57. Richard watched through the bars covering the small window in the side of his iron cage as the wagon bounced through the sprawling encampment.
"Reuben, would you take a look at that?" John Rock said. Hands gripping the bars, he was grinning like a man on holiday at what he saw. Richard glanced over at his cage mate. "Quite the sight," he agreed. "Think there's anyone here who can beat us?"
"I expect we'll find out sooner or later," Richard said.
"I'll tell you, Reuben, I'd like to get a crack at cracking some heads on the Emperor's team."
The man gave Richard a sidelong glance.
"Think if we beat the Emperor's team, they'll let us go home?"
"Are you serious?" The man huffed a laugh.
"It was a joke, Reuben."
"A poor one," Richard said.
"I suppose," John Rock said with a sigh.
"Still, they say the Emperor's team is the best. I'd not like to feel that whip again. Once was enough for me, too." The two of them had shared the iron cage ever since Richard had been captured back in Tamarang. John Rock had already been a captive, taken before Richard. He was a big man, a miller, from the southern reaches of the Midlands. Just before the supply train had moved through his little village, soldiers on lead patrol had arrived and thought that, because of his size, John Rock might make a good addition to the team. Richard didn't know John Rock's real name. It said everyone just called him John Rock because of his size and how hard his muscles were from carrying sacks of grain. He knew Richard as Reuben Ribnick. Even though John Rock was a fellow captive, Richard didn't think it would be safe to let anyone know his real name. John Rock had told Richard that he'd broken the arms of three of the soldiers trying to capture him before they took him down. Richard said only that they had pointed arrows at him, and so he'd given up. John Rock had appeared slightly embarrassed for what he saw as Richard's lack of mettle. Despite his rather goofy, lopsided grin, which he wore often and despite his circumstances, John Rock had a quick wit and an analytical mind. He had come to like Richard because Richard was the only one who didn't assume he was stupid and didn't treat him as such. John Rock was anything but stupid. He had eventually decided that he'd been wrong about Richard's lack of bravery, and had asked to be his right wingman in the Jala games. Wingman was a rather thankless position that exposed him to charges and bruises from the opponents. John Rock saw the value in such a position because it allowed him to break the heads of men from the order, and he was cheered for doing so. Even though he was a big man, John Rock was quick, a combination that made him a perfect man for Richard's right wing. He loved being close to Richard during play, so he could see Richard vent his rage on the Jala field in a way that the other teams didn't expect. Together, the two of them had become a formidable pair on the field. It was never spoken, but they both knew that the other valued the chance to extract a little bit of revenge on those who had captured them. The camp beyond the iron bars seemed to go on endlessly. Richard was sickened to see where they were, out on the Azeroth Plain around the People's Palace. He didn't want to look anymore, and sat back down, leaning up against the other side of the box, resting a wrist over his knee as the wagon swayed and bucked through the endless horde. He was relieved that the Dharan forces were long gone, or they would have by now been annihilated for nothing. Instead, those men would by now have had enough time to make it down to the old world. They were probably already laying waste to the place. Richard hoped they stuck to the plan. Fast and fierce attacks, keep separated and hit everywhere in the old world, sparing nothing. He didn't want anyone in the old world to feel safe. There needed to be consequences to the actions that flowed from their beliefs. The men in the camp all watched the wagon train passing among them. It looked to be welcome, probably for the food it brought. Richard hoped they got their fill. Knowing the orders he had given, it was likely to be one of the last supply trains to leave the old world. Without supplies, out on the Azeroth Plain, with winter about to descend upon them, Jagang's army was going to find itself unexpectedly falling on hard times. Nearly all the men they passed stared into Richard's cage, trying to get a glimpse of him. He expected that there were already rumors spreading through the camp about him and his Jala team. He had learned when they stopped to play teams at army posts along the way that their reputation preceded them. These men were fans of the game and looked forward to the tournaments, especially since there would no doubt be heightened interest because of the arrival of Richard's team, or Reuben's team, as it was informally known. The team really belonged to the commander with the snake face. There was little else to entertain these soldiers, other than the women captives. Richard tried not to think about that because it only made him angry, and there was nothing he could do about it in his cage. One day, after a particularly violent game that they had won handily, John Rock admitted to being confused as to why Richard would have allowed himself to be so easily captured. Richard finally told him the truth of what happened. John Rock at first didn't believe him. Richard told him to ask Snakeface sometime. He did, and found that Richard was telling the truth. John Rock greatly valued liberty, and thought it was worth fighting for. That was when John Rock asked to be Richard's right wingman. Where Richard had once channeled his rage through the Sword of Truth, he now channeled it through the Brock, and the play of the Jala game. Even his own team, as much as they liked him leading them, to a degree feared him. Except John Rock. John Rock didn't fear Richard. He shared Richard's way of playing, as if the game were life or death. For some of their opponents, made up of Imperial Order troops who thought too much of themselves, it had been. It was not at all unusual for players, especially opponents of Richard's team, to be seriously hurt, or even die during a match. One of the men on Richard's team had died during a game. He'd been hit in the head with a heavy brock when he wasn't looking. It snapped his neck. Richard remembered walking the streets of Idendrill with Kaelin, watching children playing Jala. He had given out official balls if they would trade in their heavy brocks for the lighter ones Richard had had made up. He didn't want them getting hurt just to play a game. Now all those children had fled Idendrill. "This looks like a bad place for us to be, Reuben," John Rock said in a quiet voice as he watched the camp roll past their little window. He sounded uncharacteristically gloomy. "A very bad place for us to be slaves." If you think you're a slave, then you are a slave, Richard said.
John Rock stared back at Richard for a long moment.
Then I'm not a slave either, Reuben.
Richard nodded. Good for you, John Rock. The man went back to watching the endless camp pass before his eyes. He had probably never seen the likes of it in his life. Richard remembered his own wonder when he first left his heartland woods to discover what was beyond.
Would you look at that?
John Rock said in a low voice, staring out through the bars.
Richard didn't feel like looking. What is it?
A lot of men, soldiers, but not like the rest of the soldiers. These all look the same. Better weapons, better organized, bigger. They look fierce. Everyone is making way for them.
John Rock looked back over his shoulder at Richard.
I bet it's the Emperor come to watch us roll by. Come to see the challengers to his team come to the tournaments. From the descriptions I've heard, I bet that fellow being guarded by all those big guards in chain mail is Jagang himself.
Richard went back to the small opening to have a look. He gripped the bars as he put his face close to see better as they passed by the guards and their charge.
That looks like it's probably Emperor Jagang, all right, Richard told John Rock.
The Emperor was looking the other way, watching some of the other Jala teams made up of Imperial Order soldiers. They weren't locked in iron boxes and wagons, of course. Jagang was watching them marching proudly in ranks, carrying banners of their team. And then he saw her.
Kaelin!
She turned toward his voice, not knowing where it was coming from. Richard was gripping the bars hard enough to nearly bend them. Even though she wasn't far, he realized that she probably couldn't hear him over all the noise. Men all around were cheering for the parade of marching teams. Her long hair was tumbled down over her cloak. Richard thought his heart would explode. It hammered so hard in his chest.
Kaelin!
She turned more toward him. Their eyes met. He was staring right into her green eyes. When Jagang started to turn around, she immediately turned away, looking off where he was watching. He turned back with her. And then she was gone, hidden behind men and wagons and horses and tents, disappearing into the distance. Richard fell back against the wall, gasping. John Rock sat down beside him.
Reuben, what's wrong? You look like you've seen a phantom walking among all those men.
Richard could only stare, his eyes wide as he panted. It was my wife.
John Rock let out a hearty laugh.
You mean you saw the woman you want when we win?
The commander says that if we beat the Emperor's team, we get to pick one. You see the one you want?
It was her.
Reuben, you look like a man who just fell in love.
Richard realized that his smile felt like it might break his face. It was her. She's alive. John Rock, I wish you could see her. She's alive. She looks exactly the same. Dear spirits, it was Kaelin. It was her.
I think you'd best slow down your breathing, Reuben. You're going to pass out before we have a chance to break some heads.
We're going to play the Emperor's team, John Rock.
We've got to win a lot of games first to have that chance.
Richard hardly heard the man. He laughed with glee, unable to stop himself.
It was her. She's alive.
Richard threw his arms around John Rock, hugging him tightly.
She's alive.
If you say so, Reuben.
Kaelin carefully controlled her breathing, trying to get her galloping heart to slow down. She couldn't understand why she was so shaken. She didn't know the man in the cage. She had only seen his face briefly as the wagon rolled past. But for some reason, it shook her down to her very soul. The second time the man yelled her name, Jagang acted like he thought he'd heard something. Kaelin had turned back around so that he wouldn't suspect anything. She didn't know why that had seemed so desperately important. That wasn't true. She did know why. The man was in a cage. If he knew her, Jagang might have hurt him, even killed him. There was more to it, though. That man knew her. He had to be connected to her past. The past she wanted to forget. But when she had looked into his gray eyes, everything had changed in a heartbeat. Her numb acceptance had shattered. She no longer wanted her past to be buried. She suddenly wanted to know everything. The look in that man's eyes was so profoundly powerful, so filled with something important, something vital, that it drove home to her how important her life was. Seeing the look in his gray eyes, Kaelin realized that she had to know who she was. Whatever the consequences, whatever the cost, she had to know the truth. She had to have her life back. The truth was the only way. Jagang's threats of what he would do to her might be a very real consequence. But she suddenly knew that the real danger was that he was intimidating her into abdicating her life, her will, her existence, into giving herself over to his control. By his threats of what he would do to her once she again knew who she was, he was dictating her life, enslaving her. If she went along with his will, then it was only because she surrendered hers. She couldn't allow herself to think that way. Her life meant more than that. She may be his captive, but she was not his slave. A slave was a state of mind. She was not a slave. She would not surrender her will to him. She would have her life back. Her life was hers alone, and she would have it back. Nothing Jagang could do, nothing he could threaten her with, could take that away from her. Kaelin felt a tear of joy roll down her cheek. That man she didn't even remember had just given her the will to take her life back, the fire to live. It felt like the first real breath she had taken since she had lost her memory. She only wished she could thank him. Chapter 58. Nikki marched through the vast hall of the People's Palace, trailing Kara, Nathan, and a gaggle of guards. Every time someone called Nathan Lord Rawl, it set her nerves on edge. She knew it was necessary, but in her heart, the only Lord Rawl was Richard. She would have given just about anything to see his gray eyes again. Being in the palace made it seem she could almost feel his presence all around her. It was the spell the palace was built around, she supposed. The palace was built in the form of a spell for the Lord Rawl. Richard was the Lord Rawl, at least in her mind. To be fair, she knew there were others, Kara for one, who felt the same. When she was alone with Kara, which was often, the two of them seemed to share understanding without words being needed. Both shared the same anguish. Both of them wanted Richard back. Kara stepped forward, leading them through a network of small service hallways to an iron stairway up a dark well. Reaching the top, she threw open the door. They were greeted with cold light as they stepped out onto the observation deck. Being right out at the edge of the outer wall, at the edge of the plateau, it felt like standing on the edge of the world. Down below, spread out like a black taint almost to the distant horizon, was the army of the Imperial Order.
"See what I mean?" Nathan said as he stepped up beside her, pointing out the construction in the distance. It was hard to see at first, but it quickly began to make sense.
"You're right," she said. "It does look like a ramp. Do you think they can actually build a ramp all the way up here?"
Nathan gazed out at the site, studying it for a moment. "I don't know, but I would have to say that if Jagang is going to all the trouble of doing such a thing, it can only be because he has reason to believe that he can accomplish it."
"If they make it up here with a ramp that broad," Kara said, "we're in trouble."
"More like dead," Nathan said.
Nikki studied what the men of the Order were doing, and the distance to the site of the work. "Nathan, you're a Rawl. This place amplifies your power. You ought to be able to send some wizard's fire down there and blow that thing apart."
"My thought, too," he said. "I suspect that they have sisters down there with shields to prevent anyone up here from doing just that. I've not probed for such defenses, and I've not tried anything yet.
I want to wait until they've been at it for quite a while longer, to make them feel complacent. Then, when they have some more done, and they're closer, and when I finally do hit them, I'll have a better chance of doing some real damage. If I'm able to destroy it now, they won't have lost much. Better to wait until they've already put a great deal more time and work into it.
Nicky frowned up at the tall prophet. Nathan, you are a very devious man. He smiled a raw smile. I prefer to think of myself as ingenious.
Nicky went back to surveying the camp out beyond the site of the construction. It was just far enough away to provide their gifted with plenty of time to react to an attack. Nicky had spent enough time with Jagang's army to know a great deal about the way they thought. She knew the layers of defenses that Jagang's officers and gifted would place around the army. And some of those gifted were Sisters of the Dark.
Look at that, she said, pointing. It looks like a supply train is just arriving.
Nathan nodded. Winter will be here shortly. The army looks like they're not going anywhere, so they will need a lot of supplies to keep all those men alive over the winter.
Nicky considered what could be done, finally deciding that, from where they stood, very little.
Well, Richard sent the army south to the Old World to attack their supply trains, among other things. Let's hope they're effective and can accomplish the task. If all those men starve to death, that would solve our problem. In the meantime, I'll devote some thought to what we might be able to do to help them die.
She turned away from the depressing view of the encampment and the supply train bringing all those men what they needed to stay and lay siege to the palace.
Come on, she said to Nathan. I need to get back. But why don't you show me before I leave?
Nathan took them down through the palace by the smaller staff areas, rather than the vast halls. It was a quick descent through the stone interior of the palace, taking them ever lower into the dark inner regions beneath the palace that most people never saw. There were elegant, if simple, stone halls even in these unseen places. Without elaborate decoration, they were made of polished stone in places and rich wood in others. These were the private corridors used by the Lord Rawl and his staff. Nicky had come to the People's Palace to pay a visit to the Garden of Life. After that, she had checked to see how Berdine was doing in her search for information, and how Nathan was getting on. They had wanted to tell her details of their difficulties. She hadn't really wanted to take the time, but she made herself listen patiently. After having again seen the place where the boxes of Warden had been, she had been too distracted to be able to really focus on what they were telling her. This time she saw the deserted Garden of Life differently. Getting a feel for where Dark and Rawl had opened the boxes, for where they had sat. She had studied the position of the room, the amount of light, the angles to various known star charts, in addition to how the sun and moon traversed the place, and the area where the spells had been invoked. Since translating the Book of Life, Nicky viewed the Garden of Life in a different way. She saw it through the context of the magic of Orden, and how the room had been used. It had given her a valuable insight into the last place the boxes had been used. Such practical reference had answered some questions she'd had, and confirmed some of the conclusions she'd come to. At last Nathan reached a set of double doors with guards standing before them. He gestured, and the men opened the pair of white doors. Beyond was a wall of white stone that looked as if it had partly melted.
"Have you been in there?" she asked the prophet.
"No," he admitted. "At my age I try to stay out of tombs as much as I can."
Nicky stepped over the low ledge at the same time as she ducked through the low opening. "Wait here," she said to Kara, who had been about to follow her in.
"Are you sure? This involves magic."
Kara wrinkled her nose as if she had gotten a whiff of sour milk, and waited outside along with the prophet. Nicky sent a spark of Han into a torch to the side. After all this time, it still lit. She saw then that the huge vaulted room was constructed of pink granite. The floor was white marble. On the walls all around were dozens and dozens of gold vases, each set in the wall beneath a torch. Nicky absently counted them. 57. It appeared to her to be a number that had meaning. Probably the vases and torches represented the age of the man in the coffin in the center of the room. The place was troubling, and not just because it was a crypt. She trailed her fingers along the symbols cut into the granite walls just beneath the vases. The words that ran around the entire room and around the golden coffin were Hai Dhaharan. The inscriptions were instructions from a father to a son on the process of going to the underworld and returning. Quite the legacy. Such spells contained subtractive magic. That was what was causing the walls to melt. Containing them by walling the place over with special stone had slowed the process greatly, but had not halted it entirely.
Well? Nathan asked, poking his head in through the melted hole. Any ideas?
Nikki stepped out, brushing off her hands. I don't know. I don't think there's any imminent danger, but this involves dark things, so there's a chance I'm wrong. I think it would be best to shield it behind an invocation of threes.
Nathan nodded in thought. You want to do it? Lace it with subtractive?
It would be best if you did it. You're a Rawl. That would be more effective.
Even if I used subtractive, this in here already has both mixed in, and it was created by a Rawl. Such power could breach any invocation I could create in here under the limitations of the protective spell of the palace. He considered only briefly. I will see to it at once. Nathan cast a look back at the crypt. Any idea of what's causing this spell to burn through?
Off the top of my head, I'd say it was activated by one of the boxes of Warden, having been opened up in the Garden of Life. I suspect they created a sympathetic reaction of some sort. It's not yet active enough for me to tell the purpose of the subtractive element, but the words inscribed on the coffin and walls indicate that the constituent composition in there was intended to be used to aid in the acquisition of the power of Warden, so they act in a harmonic response after having been in the vicinity of that specific power.
Nathan nodded in thought. All right. I'll do an invocation of threes and keep my eye on it.
I have to get back. I will check back later, just to see if you've had any word from Richard and to see how the Order is getting along out there.
Tell Zed that I have everything well in hand and I have the enemy surrounded.
Nikki smiled. I'll tell him.
On her way through the vast halls of the palace, with Kara at her side, Nikki was lost in thought. She was unsure of what to do next. There were troubling problems descending from every direction. Most felt shadowy and ill-defined. There was no one with whom she could really discuss all the things going through her mind.
Zed was a help in some of it, while Kara was good to talk to for other things.
But Richard was the only one who would be able to grasp the ways in which she was beginning to understand fundamental issues. Richard, in fact, was the one to introduce her to the concept of creative magic. She still clearly remembered that talk with him, one night at camp. It was one of the many defining moments with Richard. There were also things Richard needed to know. There were incidents involving him and the boxes of Warden that were troubling, to say the least. In a way, he had built a fire under ingredients that were not merely dangerous, but were beginning to bubble and boil, and could possibly combine on their own in the most insidious ways if action wasn't taken. There were prophecies involved that, not being a prophet, she didn't trust herself to understand. There were other prophecies that she was beginning to think she understood all too well, and could not avoid taking into consideration. Primary among those was the prophecy that said, in the year of the cicadas, which this was, when the champion of sacrifice and suffering, under the banner of both mankind and the light, finally splits his swarm, which Jagang had done, thus shall be the sign that prophecy has been awakened and the final and deciding battle is upon us. Be cautioned, for all true forks and their derivatives are tangled in this mantic root. Only one trunk branches from this conjoined primal origin. This was the time, succeed or fail, all or nothing, the watershed moment, that would forever set the course for the future. If Fuhr Grissa Ostrauka does not lead this final battle, then the world, already standing at the brink of darkness, will fall under that terrible shadow. That prophecy, she was beginning to see, was tangled in the boxes of Warden, but she couldn't quite grasp how. From time to time she felt on the brink of understanding, but she could never quite break through to it. There was something just beneath the surface of that prophecy that she knew was key. At the same time,
She felt that events were cascading, unrestrained, and she had to do something before those events tumbled out of control. With each passing day, she knew that options would continue to close for them. With the Sisters of the Dark having put the boxes in play, that had already cut off their ability to use the power of Ordin for its intended purpose, to counteract the ignition of the Chainfire event. With Chainfire contaminated by the chimes, they were rapidly losing the ability to use their gift to correct the damage. There was no telling how much longer any of them would have sufficient control of their gift necessary to be of any use in overcoming any of the obstacles they faced. At the same time, the Book of Life had come to have meaning for her that she could never have imagined. She had also studied several very obscure books Zed had found for her on Ordenic theory. They, too, had added depth to her understanding. But all of that only seemed to open other areas to bigger questions. Startled, Nikki halted and looked up. What was that? The bell for devotion, Kara said, looking a little puzzled at Nikki's reaction. Nikki watched people begin to gather before a nearby square with a pool in the center. The pool, with a large, dark rock set off center, was open to the sky. Perhaps we should go to devotion, Kara said. It sometimes helps when you're troubled, and I can tell that you are definitely troubled. Nikki frowned at the moored Sith, wondering how she knew that something was troubling her. She supposed that it really wasn't all that hard to tell. I don't have time to go to devotion, Nikki said. I have to get back and figure this out. Kara didn't look like she thought that was a good idea. She held a hand out toward the square. Thinking about Lord Rawl might help. Thinking about Nathan is not going to do me any good. I don't care if everyone thinks that Nathan is the Lord Rawl. Richard is Lord Rawl. Kara smiled. I know. That's what I meant. She took Nikki by the arm, drawing her toward the pool. Come on. Nikki stared at the woman as she was being dragged along, and then said, I suppose it couldn't hurt to stop for a short time to think about Richard. Kara nodded, looking somehow very wise at that moment. People respectfully made way for the moored Sith as she strode up to a spot near the pond. Nikki saw that there were fish gliding through the dark waters. Before she knew it, she was kneeling with Kara, putting her forehead to the floor. Master Rawl, guide us. The crowd began chanting in one voice. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Nikki added her voice to the others, and together they lifted to reverberate through the halls. The words Master Rawl and Richard seemed indistinguishable to her. They were one and the same. Almost against her will, Nikki's turbulent thoughts quieted as she softly chanted the words along with everyone else. Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light, we thrive. In your mercy, we are sheltered. In your wisdom, we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. She lost herself in the words. The sunlight was warm on her back. The next day was the first day of winter, but inside Lord Rawl's palace the sun was warm, much like up in the Garden of Life. It seemed odd in that Darkan Rawl and his father, Panis, were the Lord Rawl before, making this place the seat of evil. She realized, though, that the place was only that, a place. The man was what mattered. The man made the defining difference. The man set the tone that others followed, either rightly or wrongly. In a way, the devotion was the formal statement of that concept. Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light, we thrive. In your mercy, we are sheltered. In your wisdom, we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Those words reverberated in Nikki's mind. She missed Richard so much. Even though his heart belonged to someone else, she just missed seeing him, seeing his smile, talking to him. If that was all she could ever have, that was enough to sustain her. Just his friendship, his value in her life, and hers in his. Just Richard being happy, being alive, being Richard. Our lives are yours. Nikki abruptly rose up on her knees. She understood. Puzzled, Kara frowned up at her as everyone else chanted. What's wrong? Our lives are yours. She knew what she had to do. Nikki stood in a rush. Come on, I have to get back to the keep. As they ran together through the halls, Nikki could hear the whispering sound of voices rising up together to echo reverently through the vast corridors. Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Nikki felt herself lost in words that suddenly had meaning for her that they had never had before. She understood how it all fit together, at last, and knew what she had to do. Zed rose from his chair at the desk in the little room when he saw Nikki standing in the doorway. The lamplight softened his familiar face.
Nikki, you're back. How are things at the People's Palace?
Nikki hardly heard the question. Answering it was beyond her. Zed stepped closer, concern settling in his hazel eyes.
Nikki, what's wrong? You look like a phantom come to haunt the halls.
She had to force herself to speak. Do you trust Richard? Zed's brow drew down.
What kind of question is that?
Do you trust Richard with your life?
Zed gestured with one arm. Of course, what's this about?
Do you trust Richard with everyone's life?
Zed gently gripped her arm. Nikki, I love that boy.
Please, Zed, do you trust Richard with everyone's life?
The concern in his eyes overspread his face, deepening the creases. He finally nodded.
Of course I do. If there was ever anyone I would trust with my life, or the life of anyone, it would be Richard. After all, I'm the one who named him to be Seeker.
Nikki nodded as she turned. Thank you, Zed.
He lifted his robes a little as he hurried after her.
Do you need some help with something, Nikki?
No, she said. Thank you, I'm fine.
Zed at last nodded, taking her word for it, and returned to the book he was studying. Nikki walked through the halls of the keep without seeing them. She moved as if following an invisible glowing line to her destination, the way Richard said he could follow the glowing lines of a spell form.
Where are we going? Kara asked, rushing to follow behind. Do you trust Richard? Trust him with your life?
Of course,
Kara said without an instant of hesitation. Nikki nodded as she continued on. She passed corridors, intersections, rooms, and stairs without really seeing them. In a daze of purpose, she finally reached the hardened area of the keep and the grand room where the verification web had nearly taken her life. She would have died had it not been for Richard. He insisted on finding a way to save her when no one else believed it could be done. She trusted Richard with her life, and her life was very precious to her, thanks to him. At the double doors, Nikki turned to Kara. I need to be alone.
But I...
This involves magic.
Oh,
Kara said.
Well, all right then. I'll just wait out here in the hall in case you need anything.
Thank you, Kara. You're a good friend.
I never had any real friends, friends really worth having, until Lord Rawl came along.
Nikki smiled a little. I never had anything worth living for until Richard came along. Nikki closed the double doors. Behind her, the two-story windows flickered with lightning. Nikki didn't know if she had ever been in that room when there wasn't a storm. Now the whole world was caught in a storm. When the lightning flashed, the room lit with a harsh glare. There was one thing in the room, however, that did not register the touch of even such intense light. It waited like death itself. Nikki laid the Book of Life open on the table before the inky black box of Orton sitting in the center of the table.
It seemed that every time the lightning tried to ignite, that black box swallowed the light before it could really get started. Staring at it was like looking into forever. Nicky invoked the first spell, calling forth darkness to match the impossible blackness of the grim box sitting before her. She reminded herself that, like the People's Palace, it was the person who defined it. With a thunderclap of power filling the room, the door was barred. No one could enter. The containment field of the windows no longer mattered. She had conjured something more powerful. The room was silent and pitch black. Nikki's vision came from the powers she had called forth. She spoke the words written on the next page, invoking the next spell that opened the pathway for the governing formulas. She used a sliver of subtractive magic to void a razor-thin piece of flesh at the tip of her finger, and used the blood that began to ooze to begin drawing the diagrams needed before the Box of Warden. As more blood ran from the open wound, she drew a containment field around the box itself. It was something like the field of the room, but on a much more intense scale. Without being contained first, such power as was liberated from the Box of Warden could unintentionally breach the veil, but in a way that would kill only the person attempting what Nicky was attempting. Almost not needing to read the book that she had been studying for what seemed half her life, she went on to the equations involving the time of year, the first day of winter. Once completed, she drew the two opposing symbols and the joint of the apex from the proper charts in blood. It went on, one intense formula after another, for the next hour, with calculations bringing the resultant layer of magic forth to be folded into the next step. Each node in the book required that only the appropriate level of power be applied. At each spot, Nicky let it flow forth without reservation. There was no other way. As the night wore on, the lines of the spell built around the box, in some ways like the chain fire verification web, with lines that glowed green. But others were a pure white, while yet others were constructed of subtractive elements, and they were blacker than black, looking like nothing so much as voids in the world where the lines belonged, like slits looking into the underworld. When Nicky completed the last incantation, she finally heard the whisper of Ordin itself, confirmation that she had done everything properly. Yet it was not so much a voice as a force that formed the concept in her mind. "The power is open," it whispered through the darkness in words that felt like ice cracking. "I call upon this time, this place, this world, to turn with this play of the Boxes of Ordin." "Name the player." Nicky placed her hands on the dead black box before her. "The player is Richard Rawl," she said. "Heed his will. Do his bidding if he proves worthy. Kill him if he does not. Destroy us all if he fails us." "It is done. From this moment forward, the power of Ordin is in play by Richard Rawl." Prophecy said that if Fuhr Grissa Ostrauka does not lead this final battle, then the world, already standing at the brink of darkness, will fall under that terrible shadow. Nicky had come to realize that if Richard was to win, he must be the one leading them in this final battle. The only way to lead was for him to have the boxes in play. In that way, he truly would be the fulfillment of prophecy. Fuhr Grissa Ostrauka, the bringer of death. Prophecy said that they had to follow Richard, but it was more than prophecy. Prophecy only expressed the formality of what Nicky knew, that Richard embodied the values that promoted life. They weren't really following prophecy. Prophecy was following Richard. This was the ultimate following of Richard, following him in what he did with the Boxes of Ordin, in what he did with life and death itself. This was the ultimate test of who he was, who he would be, who he would become. Richard himself had named the terms of the engagement when he spoke to the Daharan troops, telling them how the war would be fought from now on, all or nothing. This could be no different. It now truly was all or nothing. Ulysia and her Sisters of the Dark had likewise opened the gateway to the power of Orden. The struggle was now truly in balance. If Nikki was right about Richard, and she knew she was, then two forces were now properly engaged in the struggle that would decide it all. If Fuhrer Grisser Ostrauka does not lead this final battle, then the world, already standing at the brink of darkness, will fall under that terrible shadow. They had to trust in Richard in that struggle. For that reason, Nikki had to put the boxes of Orden into play in Richard's name. The Sisters of the Dark no longer were the exclusive arbiters of the power of Orden. In that sense, Nikki had just put Richard into play, giving him the ability to win this struggle. Without what she had just done, he could not win, much less survive. Nikki seemed to drift in a world apart. When she finally opened her eyes, the storm had ended. The first rays of light were just touching the windows. It was dawn, on the first day of winter. Richard had 1 year to open the correct box. Everyone's life was now in his hands. Nikki trusted Richard with her life. She had just entrusted everyone's life to him. If she couldn't trust Richard, then life wasn't worth living.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Phantom by Terry Goodkind. Copyright 2006 by Terry Goodkind. Read by Sam Chuchevis. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Troy Harrison and Christopher Kessel. Performance copyright 2006 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. Recorded by arrangement with Pantheon Books, a division of Random House Incorporated. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.